picture this. It's Tuesday evening.
Oh, boy.
Right. You just pulled into your driveway after a really long, just grueling day at work.
Yeah.
You put the car in park, you turn the key, and the engine cuts out. You can hear that faint kind of metallic ticking sound.
As the engine cools down. Yeah.
Exactly, in the quiet of the evening. And you are sitting there in the driver's seat, just bathed in the faint glow of the dashboard lights.
Right.
And you know perfectly well what you need to do next.
You have a clear plan.
Totally clear. You need to open the car door, walk inside your house, open up your laptop, and finish drafting that project that is due tomorrow.
And your mind is completely on board with this.
Completely. Your sense of professional pride is on board, and yet what actually happens?
You don't move.
You sit there, paralyzed, your hand just sort of reaches into your pocket, you pull out your phone, and you sit in the dark for 20 straight minutes.
Mindlessly scrolling.
Mindlessly scrolling through a feed you don't even care about, feeling this quiet, creeping sense of guilt.
I mean, it is an incredibly universal human experience. I would wager almost everyone listening to this deep dive has their own version of the driveway paralysis.
Oh, absolutely.
And yet, despite how common it is, it's an experience that carries just an immense amount of quiet suffering. You know,
yeah.
we internalize it. We weaponize that hesitation against ourselves.
So much shame.
Mm-hmm.
Because society loves to frame this exact moment of hesitation, this inability to just cross the threshold of your front door and do the work, as a fundamental moral failure.
Right. The cultural narrative is so loud on this.
It's deafening. We're told that if you don't get out of the car, it means you lack discipline.
You lack willpower.
You don't have enough grit. You just don't want it badly enough. But our mission for today's deep dive is to, frankly, take a sledgehammer to that narrative.
I love that.
Today, we're going to look at the hard neurocognitive science that proves your procrastination is not a weakness of your soul.
No, it's not.
It's not a moral failing. It is a strictly mechanical failure.
It's mechanics. And to understand why we fail to act on the things we desperately want to do, we have to look under the hood of human volition.
Right.
We need to look at the actual gears and pulleys of the brain. But to truly grasp the mechanics of our willpower, we first need to set the stage a little bit.
Okay, set the stage.
We need to briefly recap how our minds establish who we are in the social world to begin with. You know, we need to look at the cognitive foundation from which all our actions spring before we transition into the machinery that decides what physical movement you actually make next.
That makes a lot of sense because we are building a complete architecture of the mind today, entirely based on the Jason Prezzart archives.
Yes.
For those who were with us on our last deep dive, we unpacked one of Prezzart's massive foundational pillars, which was simulation synchronization theory, or SST.
A brilliant framework.
So brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
And the core of SST is this really liberating idea that your personality isn't a fixed, carved in stone statue that you carry from room to room.
Right. You're not just one rigid thing.
Instead, it functions much more like active sonar.
The active sonar analogy is really the most effective way to visualize SST. I mean, think of yourself as a submarine navigating the social depths.
Okay.
You don't just exist passively in a social space. Instead, your brain is constantly generating these highly contextual internal simulations of who you need to be in any given room.
So it's projecting.
Exactly. You project that simulated identity out into the environment like a sonar ping, and then you wait.
You wait for the echo.
You wait for the social feedback to bounce back to you.
Right. You wait to see if the room validates the version of you that you just projected. Like, if you walk into a high-stakes board meeting, your brain pings a simulation of, you know, competent, serious professionals.
Yes.
And Prezzart actually formalized this entire process into a mathematical loop, breaking the human identity down into a recursive sequence of variables.
He built a functional equation for social existence. It's fascinating. It starts with S of T, which represents the simulation you are running internally at any given moment.
Okay, S of T.
That internal simulation then translates into R of T, the role you actually enact in the physical world.
Like how you stand, the tone of your voice, the words you choose.
Exactly, the physical manifestation. Then comes F of T. The feedback you receive from the room.
And this is the crucial part, right?
Oh, absolutely. The feedback is the micro expressions on people's faces, the nods of agreement, or, you know, the awkward silence after you make a joke.
Ouch. And that feedback doesn't just wash over you. It's processed immediately.
Exactly. That feedback triggers A of T, your adaptive response.
So your brain rapidly calculates the delta between the role you projected and the feedback you received.
Right. If the room is smiling and engaged, your adaptive response is to lock in that simulation and keep running it.
Keep being that guy.
Right. But if the room is staring at you blankly, your adaptive response forces you to recalibrate and run a new simulation. And the glue holding this entire sequence together, the gravity of the whole system, is EFT.
Which is the emotional weight.
The emotional weight or effective charge of the simulation, yes.
So if a simulation has a massive emotional weight, like wanting to impress a new boss or going on a first date with someone you are wildly attracted to, that loop is going to spin obsessively.
Fast and hard.
You are going to be hyper-attuned to every single micro-expression, constantly adjusting your behavior until the room synchronizes with your simulation.
The higher the emotional weight, the more processing power the brain dedicates to achieving synchronization. That's why high-stakes social situations are so physically exhausting.
Because your brain is running the SRFA loop at maximum capacity.
It's spicy.
Okay, let's unpack this for a second, because SST perfectly explains the who.
It does.
It maps out how the brain mathematically calibrates who you are in a specific room based on the social feedback you're receiving. It explains why you feel like a completely different person at a dive bar with your childhood friends than you do sitting across from a loan officer at a bank.
Right. Different rooms, different simulations.
But as I was reviewing the archives for today, focusing on this driveway paralysis problem, a glaring gap jumped out at me.
What was it?
SST gives us the input. It maps the environmental processing, and it tells us how we adapt our internal identity. But there is a massive piece missing.
Yes.
How does the human organism actually decide what physical action to take next?
You've hit the exact boundary of the theory.
Right. I mean, knowing who I am in a room doesn't explain the mechanics of movement. If I'm in the board meeting, SST tells me my role is competent and professional. But how do I decide to physically open my mouth and speak?
Yes.
Or in the driveway scenario, my identity as a responsible worker is fully synchronized. I know where I am, so why can't I open the car door?
That is the exact threshold we are crossing today. SST brilliantly maps the input and the internal identity processing, but as you deduced, it lacks an output layer.
An output layer, okay.
Knowing who you are and what the room expects of you is only half the cognitive battle. To understand action, to understand why the hand reaches for the phone instead of the door handle, we must cross over into a different framework within Breesart's architecture.
Okay, where are we going?
We must enter the intent resolution engine, or the IRE. This is the neurocognitive system that governs the vector-based arbitration of human willpower.
The intent resolution engine. I mean, just the name alone sounds like a piece of heavy industrial machinery.
It kind of is.
Breesart released the IRE framework in June of 2025, and reading through his notes, it's clear this was his direct attempt to answer that ultimate agonizing question. Why do we fail to act on what we consciously intend?
And his answer fundamentally reorganizes how we view ourselves and our perceived failures. The IRE framework proposes that the painful gap between knowing what you should do and actually executing the action is not a flaw in your character.
Thank God.
It is a system-level bottleneck. And we can actually map this bottleneck to specific neurological geography, primarily within the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex.
The dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, the DLPFC. So we are talking about a literal biological traffic jam in the executive center of the brain.
Exactly. Think about how we intuitively view our own intentions. We have this almost romanticized binary view of our desires.
Like you either want to do something or you don't.
Right. You either have the intention to write your novel today or you don't. And if you have the intention but fail to act, the logical conclusion in a binary system is that you are simply weak.
Which brings on the shame.
But the IRE framework shatters that binary illusion entirely. Intentions do not exist in a vacuum, and they are not simple on-off switches.
They are multidimensional vectors.
Yes.
This was the concept that gave me that feeling of just like fascinating clarity. When I read that, it felt like someone handed me the blueprints to my own frustration. An intention isn't a wish. It's a literal neurological force.
It has direction, and crucially, it has magnitude. And at any given sub-second interval, that specific intention vector is not operating alone.
What's it doing?
It is constantly competing against dozens, sometimes hundreds, of other intention vectors in a rapid recursive arbitration loop within the prefrontal cortex.
So sitting in the car, I don't just have one intention to go inside and work. Mm. I have a vector for go inside, a vector for recline the seat and close my eyes, a vector for check my email, a vector for scroll social media, and a vector for turn the car back on and drive to get fast food.
And your brain is trying to arbitrate all of these forces simultaneously.
Just constantly crunching the numbers.
And doing so requires immense computational power. When you view an intention not as a moral imperative, but as a composite vector of cognitive and emotional data fighting for supremacy in a biological system, you can finally stop judging yourself.
You stop asking, why am I so lazy?
Right, and you start asking, what were the variables that caused my preferred vector to fail the arbitration process?
So let's look at the mechanics of that failure. Let's deconstruct the math of human willpower. Brizard lays out a symbolic formalism for this intention vector, proposing that the strength of any given intention, what's called the overall vector V, is a function of five interrelated variables.
Every single time your brain considers taking an action, your prefrontal cortex rapidly computes the strength of that intention by calculating these five factors.
It's just wild to think this happens in milliseconds.
And the beautiful part is that we can map these variables onto incredibly mundane, everyday struggles.
Let's do exactly that. Rather than just listing out the variables like a textbook, let's build a scenario. Let's drag this math into the real world. Let's look at the gym scenario.
A classic volitional battleground.
The absolute classic.
Right.
Okay, it's 6:00 p.m. You just got home from work. You were sitting on your couch, still in your work clothes, and you have this intention. I should go to the gym.
Okay.
How does the intent resolution engine process this? What is the very first variable it calculates?
The first variable evaluated is C, which stands for cognitive relevance.
Cognitive relevance.
This is the intellectual importance or the logical salience of the goal. It's your brain asking, does our conscious, rational mind believe this action is important to our overarching life strategy?
In the gym scenario, the cognitive relevance is incredibly high. I am intellectually aware that cardiovascular health is important for my longevity.
Yeah.
I know that lifting weights prevents bone density loss. The logic is bulletproof. My brain says, yes, this is a highly relevant action.
But logic alone rarely moves the human animal.
Oh, don't I know it.
The engine then calculates the second variable, A, the effective charge.
The effective charge.
This is the raw emotional energy, the visceral passion behind the intention. Emotion acts as the fuel for the engine.
And here is where the gym vector starts to fall apart.
Usually, yes.
Because while the logic is high, the effective charge is abysmal. I am physically tired from staring at spreadsheets all day. I actively hate the feeling of being on an elliptical machine. There is zero passion pushing me out the door.
Zero fuel.
In fact, the effective charge might even be a negative number because the thought of the gym induces a mild sense of dread.
And the brain recognizes that negative emotional weight. It logs a very low A variable. Next, the arbitration loop evaluates the physical reality of the organism by calculating X, which stands for contextual fit.
Contextual fit. So this is the friction of the environment.
It measures how well your current physical and social surroundings support the intended action. The brain is constantly asking, does our environment make this action seamless, or does it introduce barriers?
Sitting on the couch, the contextual fit is terrible. I'm sunk into soft cushions. I am wearing slacks and a button-down shirt.
Yeah.
My gym bag is upstairs in a closet, completely unpacked.
It's a logistical nightmare for your brain.
The physical friction required just to stand up, walk upstairs, find my shorts, change my clothes, find my keys, and get back in the car. It's a massive sequence of micro actions. The environment is actively pinning me to the sofa.
You've identified a massive source of vector failure. We constantly underestimate how much volitional energy is drained simply by overcoming environmental friction.
It's huge.
But the engine isn't done calculating. It moves on to R, reward expectancy.
Okay, reward expectancy.
This relies on the brain's internal prediction market. What is the anticipated neurochemical payoff if we successfully execute this action? Will we get a hit of dopamine, a surge of serotonin? And crucially, how soon will that reward arrive?
And this is where human evolution works against us, doesn't it?
Profoundly. Our brains evolved in an environment where rewards needed to be immediate finding berries, securing shelter, evading a predator.
We want the berries now.
Exactly. We are wired for immediate neurochemical payoffs. The brain heavily discounts rewards that are delayed into the distant future. This phenomenon is known as hyperbolic discounting.
Which means the reward expectancy for the gym is practically zero in the immediate term. If I go to the gym today, I do not get six-pack abs tonight.
Unfortunately.
My cholesterol doesn't instantly drop. The reward is heavily delayed. I won't see the physical payoff of this action for at least 6 months. The brain looks at that timeline and says, that's a terrible investment of energy.
The neurochemical ROI is simply too low to motivate immediate action, which brings the engine to the final variable. OMO, urgency.
Urgency.
This is the time sensitivity of the vector. The amygdala and the prefrontal cortex communicate to ask, what are the immediate catastrophic consequences if we delay this action?
Does a bomb go off if I don't go to the gym right now? No. If I skip the gym today, absolutely nothing bad happens.
Yep.
I don't get fired. My house doesn't burn down. My cardiovascular system doesn't instantly collapse.
There is no tiger chasing you.
I can easily rationalize the delay. I can tell myself, I'll just go tomorrow. Tomorrow's a better day for back and biceps anyway. The urgency is zero.
So let's look at the composite score of this gym vector. You have high cognitive relevance, yes, but it is entirely undermined by low effective charge, terrible contextual fit, heavily delayed reward expectancy, and zero urgency.
The mathematical result is an incredibly weak neurological force.
Extremely weak.
The vector is practically anemic. It has almost no magnitude whatsoever. But here is the fascinating twist that Brizard introduces. The intuitive assumption is that my weak gym vector is actively competing against a much stronger watch TV vector.
Right.
I always pictured it like two intentions in a boxing ring, fighting each other for control of my nervous system.
It is entirely natural to view our choices as direct zero-sum competitions between opposing desires. You know, the angel on one shoulder and the devil on the other.
Exactly.
But the IRE framework reveals that vectors do not fight each other directly. They aren't in a boxing ring.
They're not.
No, they are actually competing against something much more formidable, a mechanism deeply embedded in your neurobiology that governs the flow of all action.
Blizzard introduces a mechanism called the dynamic resolution threshold. And the analogy he uses in the archives to explain this is just phenomenal.
It really makes the math accessible.
He says you need to picture the arbitration loop in your prefrontal cortex as a very exclusive high-end nightclub.
It's a perfect visualization of how the brain gates action.
So imagine this nightclub in your brain.
Yeah.
And standing outside the front door of this club is a massive, intimidating bouncer. The bouncer is the dynamic resolution threshold, denoted as T in Brizard's mathematical model.
The bouncer is T.
Your intention vectors, the gym vector, the novel writing vector, the email sending vector, they are the people waiting in line outside, desperately trying to get into the club. If a vector has enough composite strength, it gets past the bouncer, enters the club, and translates into physical action. Your body actually moves.
But the key word in Brizard's model is dynamic.
Dynamic, meaning it changes.
The bouncer does not treat every night the same. The threshold fluctuates wildly based on your physiological and psychological state. The cover charge is always changing.
Let's explore how the bouncer behaves on a perfect day. Let's say it's Saturday morning. You slept for 9 uninterrupted hours. You woke up naturally, had a great cup of coffee, the sun is shining, and you have zero immediate stressors. You are flush with energy. What is the bouncer doing on a morning like that?
To understand the bouncer, we have to look at the subthalamic nucleus and the orbitofrontal cortex. These are the brain regions that constantly monitor the organism's energy reserves and allostatic load, essentially the wear and tear on the body.
Okay, the biological dashboard.
On a well-rested Saturday morning, these regions detect high levels of available glucose, low levels of the stress hormone cortisol, and a fully cleared backlog of adenosine, which is the chemical that makes you feel sleepy.
The dashboard is completely green.
The dashboard is green. The brain realizes it is flush with resources. So the orbitofrontal cortex sends a signal to the bouncer to relax.
Just chill out.
Exactly. The resolution threshold drops significantly. The bouncer unhooks the velvet rope, smiles, and essentially says, cover charge is waived. Come on in, everybody.
Because the threshold is so low, even your weakest, most trivial intention vectors can easily cross it and become physical action.
Absolutely.
This perfectly explains those bizarre Saturday mornings where you suddenly find yourself happily organizing your sock drawer or alphabetizing your spice rack or deeply cleaning the grout in your bathroom.
You're not forcing it.
No. The vectors for those tasks aren't particularly strong. The cognitive relevance of an alphabetized spice rack is quite low. But the threshold is virtually non-existent, so they glide right in. You are in a state of high volitional fluidity.
Action flows effortlessly because the brain isn't guarding its energy reserves.
But life is rarely a well-rested Saturday morning.
Very rarely.
Most of our lives are lived in the margins of exhaustion. Let's go back to that Tuesday evening in the car. You have had a long, high-stress day. Your boss criticized your work, you skipped lunch, so your blood glucose is crashing, your cortisol is spiking, and you are experiencing severe cognitive fatigue from making decisions all day. What happens to the bouncer at the nightclub now?
The biological dashboard is flashing red. The brain recognizes a state of severe resource depletion. And we have to remember, the primary directive of the nervous system is not productivity, it is survival.
Survival.
Survival requires strict energy conservation. The orbital frontal cortex detects the systemic fatigue and triggers an emergency protocol. It sends a signal to dramatically raise the resolution threshold.
It panics.
It's trying to protect the organism from burning its last remaining precious calories on non-essential, high-effort tasks.
The bouncer becomes an absolute tyrant.
The velvet rope is locked tight. The cover charge to get into the nightclub skyrockets. Now, consider your most important intentions, what we might call your VIP vectors.
Like the important stuff.
Right. This is your intention to write the manuscript that will advance your career, or the intention to have a difficult, emotionally taxing conversation with your partner, or the intention to get out of the car and do 2 hours of deep work.
These VIP vectors walk up to the door. They're wearing their expensive suits, they're flashing their high cognitive relevance badges, demanding entry because they are logically important to my future.
And what does the bouncer do?
The bouncer just looks at them, shakes his head, and says, "Not tonight. The cover charge is $10,000, and you barely have 50 bucks. You don't have enough composite strength to cross the threshold."
The VIP intentions are summarily rejected. They bounce off the threshold. Your prefrontal cortex evaluates their composite strength, the CAXRU math, against the artificially high fatigue threshold, and the math simply fails.
The action is aborted before the motor cortex even receives a signal.
Exactly.
And this is it. This is the anatomical location of paralysis.
Yeah.
This is sitting in the car, staring at the steering wheel, desperately wanting to go inside and work on the project, but the vector physically cannot cross the threshold.
You are blocked by your own neurobiology.
You literally cannot make yourself move, not because your soul is weak, but because your orbitofrontal cortex is hoarding glucose.
It is an evolutionary defense mechanism operating exactly as designed.
But wait, I have to challenge this model, because as I was reading this, a glaring contradiction hit me.
Okay, what is it?
If the bouncer is so incredibly strict because I am exhausted, if the brain is in full lockdown mode to conserve energy, rejecting all my VIP intentions, then why do I end up staying awake for 3 hours, sitting in a dark car, scrolling through short-form videos on my phone? Scrolling is an action. My thumb is moving. My visual cortex is processing rapid imagery. My brain is firing. If the club is locked down, how on earth did the doom-scrolling vector get inside?
That paradox is exactly what Brizard sought to solve. It is the defining question of modern procrastination. Why do we engage in useless, time-consuming activities when we are supposedly too tired to do important things?
Right.
The answer lies in the specific mathematical profile of the doom-scrolling vector.
Let's run the math on doom-scrolling. What makes it so insidious?
Consider the variables. What is the cognitive relevance, the C, of scrolling through random videos?
Zero. It adds no intellectual value to my life.
Well, look at the contextual fit, the X. It is absolutely perfect.
It really is.
The phone is already in your hand. The screen is illuminated. You don't have to change clothes, move to a different room, or set up a workspace. The environment offers zero friction.
And the effective charge, the A.
It's a low-level, continuous drip of novelty. It requires absolutely no deep emotional investment, no vulnerability, no risk of failure. It is safe, passive engagement.
But the real kicker is the reward expectancy, isn't it?
Yeah.
The R is fundamentally weaponized by these apps.
The R is mathematically engineered for immediate yield. Unlike the gym, where the reward is 6 months away, the reward for scrolling is microseconds away.
A micro hit of dopamine every single time your thumb swipes up.
It exploits the brain's hyperbolic discounting flawlessly.
So the composite strength of the doom-scrolling vector is entirely built on perfect contextual fit and immediate micro-rewards. But does that make it strong enough to beat the exhausted, tyrannical bouncer?
It doesn't have to beat the bouncer.
What do you mean?
The most important factor of the scrolling vector is its sheer lack of resistance. Scrolling requires an intention vector strength of near absolute zero. It requires practically no physical exertion, no emotional regulation, and no cognitive heavy lifting from the DLPFC.
It's a zero effort option.
Yes.
So while my VIP intention to write the manuscript is standing outside arguing with the bouncer because it requires too much energy, the doom-scrolling vector just drops to the ground and crawls right under the velvet rope.
It slips right under the threshold. Your brain allows the scrolling action to proceed precisely because it does not trigger the high threshold energy alarms.
That's wild.
The brain evaluates the energetic cost and essentially says, well, we absolutely do not have the glucose reserves to write a novel tonight, but flicking a thumb burns virtually no calories, and it provides a steady stream of cheap dopamine, so allow it to pass.
That reframing is incredible. You aren't doom scrolling because you are a fundamentally lazy person with no ambition.
Huh.
You are doom scrolling because, in a state of exhaustion, it is the only vector mathematically weak enough to bypass the fatigue threshold your brain has erected to protect you.
It's an ancient energy conservation strategy that has been horribly hijacked by modern digital environments.
The technology has evolved to perfectly exploit the biological loopholes in our intent resolution engine.
It has. But realizing this mechanical truth leads us toward a much deeper, somewhat unsettling territory.
Huh?
We are talking about these intention vectors as if they are mathematical formulas executing in a biological computer. We are describing a system where variables are calculated, a threshold is measured, and an action either occurs or it doesn't, all based on resource allocation.
I see where you're going with this, the dark side of the loop.
If our actions are simply the result of a sub-second arbitration loop hidden in our prefrontal cortex, where is our free will?
We are wading into the deep philosophical waters now.
Yeah.
And Brizard doesn't shy away from this in the archives. In fact, he explicitly connects the intent resolution engine to the illusion of conscious agency.
He roots a lot of his theory in some very famous, very controversial neuroscience from the 1980s.
The Benjamin Libet experiments. They are foundational to understanding the limits of conscious choice. Let's break those experiments down because they are mind-bending. What did Libet actually prove about human movement?
Libet designed a deceptively simple experiment. He hooked participants up to an electroencephalogram, an EEG machine, to monitor their brain activity.
Okay.
He placed them in front of a specialized, fast-moving clock. The instructions were simple. Perform a voluntary physical action, like flexing your wrist or pressing a button whenever you feel the urge to do so. Just do it spontaneously.
But he asked them to track the exact moment they made the decision, right?
Yes. They were told to note the exact position of the clock hand at the precise millisecond they consciously felt the urge, the explicit intention to move their wrist. Libet was trying to map the timeline of a conscious decision translating into physical movement.
Intuitively, we all assume we know how that timeline works. Step one, I consciously decide to move my wrist. Step two, my brain sends a signal down my arm. Step three, my wrist moves.
That is the narrative of free will. But the EEG data revealed a timeline that completely shattered that narrative.
What did it show?
The data showed that the supplementary motor area and the motor cortex, the regions of the brain responsible for planning and initiating physical movement, began firing hundreds of milliseconds before the participant reported feeling the conscious urge to move.
That timeline is existentially terrifying. The brain started building the electrical charge to move the wrist before the person even knew they wanted to move their wrist.
Precisely. This buildup of neurological activity is known as the readiness potential. The physical machinery of the brain had already initiated the action sequence. The gears were already turning before the conscious mind was ever made aware of the intention.
So the action starts, and then a fraction of a second later, my conscious mind says, I think I'll move my wrist now.
Yes.
It implies that our feeling of choosing to do something is just a post hoc illusion. We aren't making decisions. We are just observing decisions that our biology has already made.
Brizard argues that under the IRE framework, this chronological delay makes perfect sense. The arbitration of intention vectors, the complex math of C, A, X, R, and U against the dynamic threshold T, is happening entirely in the background.
It's just running code.
It is a rapid recursive loop executed by the brain's hardware, completely hidden from your conscious awareness.
The bouncer's doing his job in the dark. We don't get to see the negotiation at the door.
We don't see the negotiation. The vectors are evaluated, the math is calculated, and finally, one vector possesses the composite strength to cross the threshold. The loop locks onto a winner.
And then what?
The exact millisecond that vector crosses the threshold, the readiness potential spikes and the action sequence begins. It is only after the bouncer has let the action into the club, after the physical sequence is locked in, that your prefrontal cortex sends a notification to your conscious awareness.
My conscious mind is literally just the PR department.
That's a great way to put it.
My brain does all the sub-second vector math in the dark. make the decision based on glucose levels and contextual fit, starts moving my arm, and then hands my conscious mind a press release saying, hey, we decided to pick up this cup of coffee. Good job making a choice.
Exactly.
And my conscious mind sits there reading the press release thinking, wow, I have great free will. I am the master of my destiny.
It is a profound and somewhat chilling reframing of human agency. It suggests that consciousness is not the captain of the ship steering the wheel. It is the narrator standing on the deck, explaining why the ship is turning after the rudder has already shifted.
But if consciousness is just the narrator, that leads to a feeling of total helplessness.
Uh-huh.
If the math decides everything, am I just a biological automaton? Brizard doesn't leave us in that nihilistic void, does he?
No, he doesn't. Because while you may not consciously control the micro-millisecond threshold crossing, you have massive deliberate influence over the variables that go into the equation long before the loop ever locks.
Okay, good.
We'll explore how you can hack those variables in a moment. But to truly map the system, we first need to look at what happens when the arbitration loop is bypassed entirely. Because the brain doesn't actually calculate a complex five-variable equation for every single movement we make.
Right. I don't stand at my front door and calculate the cognitive relevance and effective charge of turning the doorknob.
Exactly. And that brings us to the mechanics of habit formation. The brain is, above all else, an energy-optimizing machine.
It wants to be efficient.
The prefrontal arbitration loop, the nightclub bouncer evaluating every single vector against the threshold, requires a significant amount of cognitive processing power. It burns glucose.
Yeah.
If you execute the identical intention vector over and over again in the exact same context, the brain recognizes an inefficiency. It realizes it is wasting precious energy constantly evaluating a choice that always results in the same outcome.
So the brain builds a back door into the club.
It physically alters its own architecture. Through repetition, the neural pathways begin to myelinate.
Myelinate? What's that?
Myelin is essentially an insulating sheath that wraps around the nerve fibers, allowing the electrical signals to travel faster and more efficiently. As this pathway thickens, the execution of the vector is routed away from the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. The decision-making center is cut out of the loop.
Where does the vector go if it bypasses the prefrontal cortex?
It is routed down into the basal ganglia.
The basal ganglia.
It's an older, deeper brain structure that functions as the brain's automatic execution center. It handles chunking, taking a sequence of actions, and bundling them into a single automatic routine.
So once a vector is stored in the basal ganglia, it bypasses the bouncer entirely.
It no longer needs to be evaluated against the resolution threshold. You encounter the environmental cue, and the action fires automatically with almost zero cognitive load.
Which is fantastic for brushing your teeth or driving your standard route to work without thinking about it.
Very useful.
But I imagine this back door becomes devastating when the habit is destructive. When the habit is smoking a cigarette every time you feel stressed, or instantly opening a social media app the second you feel a micro ounce of boredom. The bouncer isn't checking IDs for those actions anymore. They just walk right in through the kitchen.
That is the double-edged sword of habitual bypasses. They save energy, but they rob you of the arbitration space where you could choose differently. But there is another phenomenon we must discuss. One that is much darker and more painful than bad habits. We've talked about what happens when a vector gets in and what happens when it becomes an automatic habit. But we haven't discussed what happens to the vectors that the bouncer constantly rejects.
The VIP vectors that get turned away at the door. The intention to write the novel, or maybe more poignantly, the intention to confront a toxic family member or leave a bad relationship.
What happens to those intentions? Do they just evaporate? Do they die on the sidewalk outside the club?
They absolutely do not, especially not if they carry a massive emotional charge. Brizard outlines a phenomenon in the archives called affective vector rebound.
Affective vector rebound.
And it explains one of the most agonizing mental states a human being can experience.
Okay, I want to understand the mechanics of a rebound. What is actually happening in the brain?
Let's construct a scenario. You have an intention vector to confront a highly toxic boss about their behavior.
Okay, stressful. The cognitive relevance is very high logically. You know, you need to set boundaries for your career and mental health. But the affective charge, the emotion tied to this vector, is overwhelmingly heavy.
It's terrifying.
It is rooted in deep anxiety, fear of retaliation, perhaps even echoes of unresolved trauma regarding authority figures.
So the vector is incredibly dense with emotional weight. It's vibrating with it.
Yes. You walk into the office, you approach your boss's desk, and the vector approaches the threshold. But the sheer terror of the confrontation, the anticipated social conflict, causes the brain to perceive an immediate threat to its stability.
It freaks out.
The right inferior frontal gyrus, the region of the brain that handles inhibitory control, slams the door shut.
It vetoes it.
The brain forcefully raises the threshold in an act of self-defense. The vector is suppressed. You smile, you nod, you ask about their weekend, and you don't say a word about the toxic behavior.
The bouncer rejected the action. The right inferior frontal gyrus put the brakes on, and I failed to execute.
You failed to execute the action, but the vector was not destroyed. The laws of emotional physics apply here. Because the effect of charge, that massive buildup of anxiety, anger, and adrenaline, was not discharged through physical action, the vector retains its energetic momentum.
So where does it go?
It bounces off the closed threshold, retreats momentarily into the cognitive background, and then, because the emotional weight is so incredibly heavy, it rebounds straight back into the arbitration loop.
It gets back in line for the club. It doesn't take no for an answer.
And it gets back in line aggressively. This is the mechanical explanation for obsessional cycling and intrusive thoughts.
Oh, wow.
Think about the physiological reality of this. You are lying in bed at 2 p.m., your heart rate is slightly elevated, your body feels warm, and your brain is endlessly simulating the argument you didn't have with your boss.
You're playing out the dialogue over and over.
Over and over. The vector keeps hitting the threshold, being suppressed because there is no immediate contextual fit to have the argument while lying in your bedroom and rebounding back into your awareness.
That agonizing tension. Knowing exactly what you need to do, feeling the intense, almost painful emotional pressure to do it, but being physically paralyzed in the moment.
Yeah.
It's just a heavy vector endlessly bouncing off a closed door.
It is the cognitive equivalent of putting a car in neutral and revving the engine to the red line. It burns massive amounts of emotional fuel. It generates immense heat and stress within the nervous system, but it produces absolutely zero forward movement.
That is such a vivid, painful image, the engine screaming in neutral. It perfectly encapsulates the exhaustion of feeling stuck in your own life.
Yes.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener?
We have mapped out this incredibly complex, highly mechanical, and somewhat deterministic machinery. We know that procrastination is a vector failing to cross a fatigue threshold. We know that intrusive thoughts are heavy vectors rebounding off a closed door.
We know our conscious mind might just be the PR department.
Right. How do we take the keys to this machine? How do we stop being victims of our own sub-second math and start hacking the system? To effectively hack the system, we first have to recognize the fundamental flaw in how modern society teaches us to deal with inaction. If you want to stop procrastinating, the entire self-help industry, the motivational speakers on YouTube, the hustle culture influencers, they all give you the exact same structural advice.
They tell you to pump yourself up, find your why, listen to a hype playlist, watch a video of a billionaire screaming at you to wake up at 4 a.m. and grind harder. No excuses.
Look at that advice through the lens of the IRE mathematical model. When you try to pump up your motivation using a hype video, what are you actually doing structurally?
What am I doing?
You are attempting to artificially inflate a single variable in the equation, the effective charge, the A.
You are trying to dump massive amounts of emotional fuel onto the vector to make it heavy enough to crash through the bouncer by brute force.
Exactly. And to be fair, occasionally that brute force method works. If the threshold is only moderately high, a sudden burst of emotional intensity, getting angry at yourself or feeling deeply inspired for 5 minutes, might push the vector over the line.
But what happens if you are attempting this strategy when your system is deeply exhausted, burned out, or chronically stressed?
The bouncer is already demanding a massive cover charge because your orbifrontal cortex is desperately trying to conserve glucose.
Yes.
And trying to artificially crank up your effective charge when your system is depleted is like walking up to a nightclub, realizing the bouncer is demanding a $10,000 cover charge, and instead of walking away, you frantically start checking your pockets, maxing out your credit cards, and draining your life savings account just to force your way through the door for one night.
It's financially ruinous.
Yeah.
Or, in the case of the brain, biologically ruinous.
It leads directly to systemic burnout. You might force the action once or twice through sheer emotional adrenaline, but the energetic cost is entirely unsustainable. You will eventually crash.
The brain won't let you keep doing it.
No, the allostatic load becomes too heavy, and the brain will raise the threshold even higher the next day to compensate for the biological damage you did by forcing the system.
So the standard self-help advice is structurally flawed because it focuses entirely on fighting the threshold rather than manipulating the variables around it.
The most effective way to hack the intent resolution engine is never to fight the bouncer. It is to quietly lower the cover charge.
Okay, let's get deeply tactical here. Let's workshop a complex real-world listener scenario. Let's say you are working a demanding 9-to-5 job, but you have a dream of starting a side hustle, maybe freelance writing or coding an app. Every day you tell yourself, I will work on my side hustle for 2 hours after dinner. And every night you end up doom scrolling.
A very common scenario.
How do you biologically convince the bouncer to drop the velvet rope for that specific side hustle vector?
Step one is manipulating the threshold itself, T. Before you even attempt to work, you must signal to the orbitofrontal cortex and the subthalamic nucleus that the organism is safe, well-resourced, and not in an energy crisis. You must actively reduce your cognitive load and physiological stress.
So instead of watching a motivational video after dinner, what should you do?
You need to repair the hardware so the software can run. It looks deceptively simple, which is why ambitious people often ignore it. If you are paralyzed, step away from the high-stress environment. Mm. Take a 20-minute nap right after work.
A nap?
Yes. Why? Because it clears the adenosine buildup in the brain, instantly lowering the fatigue signal. Eat a proper, nutrient-dense meal to restore blood glucose levels, which the prefrontal cortex desperately needs to run the arbitration loop efficiently.
Give the brain its fuel.
Go for a quiet 20-minute walk without your phone. This stimulates the vagus nerve, dropping the heart rate and lowering cortisol levels.
You are manually shifting the biological dashboard from red back to green. You lower the physiological stress, the brain registers that the energy crisis is over, and the bouncer naturally lowers the threshold.
Yes.
Suddenly, that VIP vector for coding the app doesn't need to be forced. The cover charge is affordable again.
You calibrate the threshold. But lowering T is only half the strategy. We can also hack the variables of the vector itself. If you don't want to rely entirely on managing your energy, you manipulate the CAXRU equation. And by far, the most powerful and easiest variable to manipulate is X, contextual fit.
I love hacking X. This is where we become the architects of our own behavior. Contextual fit is a measure of how much friction your environment is applying to your intention. In the side hustle scenario, if you finish dinner, sit on the couch, turn on the TV just for a minute, and leave your laptop zipped up in your work bag. The contextual fit for working on the app is terrible. The environment is actively fighting the vector.
The friction is too high, so how do you change the math?
You alter the physical reality of your environment to pull your cognitive system naturally toward the action. Before you leave for your 9-to-5 in the morning, you set up your workspace. You put your laptop open on the desk. You close all work tabs and open only the coding software. You put a glass of water and your favorite notebook right next to the keyboard.
Think about what that does to the arbitration loop when you walk into that room after dinner.
When you walk in, the contextual fit variable skyrockets. The physical friction of finding the laptop, opening the software, and transitioning mindsets is entirely gone. You are physically drawn into the task. The environment now fully supports the vector.
And because the X variable is so high, the composite strength of the overall side hustle vector increases dramatically. But we can take it even further. We can hack R, reward expectancy.
How do we do that? The reward for a side hustle is usually years away.
You artificially manufacture micro-rewards. You don't focus on the million-dollar app launch. You pair the action with an immediate, tangible reward. You only allow yourself to drink your favorite expensive coffee or listen to your favorite deep dive while you are sitting at that specific desk working on the app. You tether an immediate dopamine release to the difficult action.
You are tricking the brain's hyperbolic discounting.
Yes.
And what about you? Urgency. We established earlier that there is no urgency to a side hustle. If you don't code tonight, you don't get fired.
So you manufacture the stakes. You build artificial urgency. You tell a friend, I will send you a screenshot of my completed code by 9:00 p.m. tonight. If I don't, I owe you $50. Suddenly, the amygdala registers a mild social and financial threat. The U variable spikes.
Look at what we just did to the math. We lowered the threshold by taking a nap and eating. We spiked the contextual fit by setting up the desk. We hacked the reward expectancy with a coffee ritual. We spiked the urgency with a social contract.
The composite strength of the vector is now massive.
It becomes so strong that it bypasses the bouncer effortlessly. It feels like you didn't even have to use willpower. The action just flowed naturally from the ecosystem you engineered.
you stop relying on the brute force of emotional charge, and you start engineering your reality to mathematically guarantee that your preferred intentions win the sub-second arbitration loop.
That is an incredibly liberating shift in perspective. It takes the heavy, moralistic weight entirely off our shoulders. If we summarize everything we've unpacked today, from simulation synchronization theory mapping our identity in the social room to the intent resolution engine calculating the vectors of our physical actions, we arrive at a profoundly mechanical view of the human experience.
It is a mechanical view, but paradoxically, it is a view that offers incredible agency. Procrastination is not a permanent stain on your character. It is simply the mathematical failure of a vector to cross a dynamic threshold.
And intrusive thoughts are not a sign of a broken, chaotic mind. They are just heavy vectors predictably bouncing off a closed door.
Exactly. You do not need louder goals. You do not need heavier guilt. You need clearer thresholds and smarter calibration of your environment. You are the operator of your cognitive machinery.
Once you understand the equations, once you see the bouncer at the door, you can stop fighting yourself and start calibrating the engine.
It is the ultimate transition from being a helpless passenger in your own mind to becoming the active system administrator of your biology.
As we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final provocative thought to mull over as you go about the rest of your day. We spent time exploring those Libet experiments. We talked about how the prefrontal cortex calculates these vectors in the dark, in sub-second recursive loops, locking onto a winner before you even realize a decision has been made.
The readiness, potential firing in the motor cortex long before conscious awareness catches up.
Right. Think about the bouncer dropping the velvet rope, letting the action into the club, the gears of your body beginning to move, and only then handing your conscious mind the press release saying, "You chose to do this."
It's quite a thought.
As you move through your day to day, as you reach out to pick up your keys, as you decide what words to use in an email to a coworker, as you choose whether to go to the gym or sit in your car just a few minutes longer, ask yourself
the big question.
If your actions are ultimately decided by sub-second vector math happening behind a closed door in your prefrontal cortex, and your conscious mind is just the PR department explaining the brain's math to yourself after the fact, who is the you that is actually making the choices in your life?
Are you the true author of your actions, or just the very convincing narrator of a story your biology has already written?
It's enough to keep you sitting in your car with the engine off just a little bit longer.